step, whatever word it is they're giving me today. I just want to start off with a little bit of poetic foreplay. One day I will swallow up the world. And when I do, I hope you all perish violently.
Now you look like shit.
Yeah, I look like I always look.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Subbeacon, sponsored by Calm, the number one app for sleep, meditation, and relaxation. I'm Victor Manis, along with Sonny Bunch and Jonathan V. Last. I'd like to remind you, the Subbeacon is available on iTunes and Google Play. Just look at our podcast and search for Subbeacon. You'll easily find us. Please subscribe, tell your friends, and leave a review. Gentlemen, how are we? JVL, what is going on?
Hello, boys.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine, I think.
I was going to talk about a little bit of baseball because the season is underway.
The season has begun.
The season has begun. Flash had his first travel league doubleheader on a windy, windy afternoon on Sunday out in Reston, Virginia, a mere hour and 15 minutes from my home.
Is a doubleheader in the same place, though, at least? Okay, yes. Good. All right, all right.
They split the games. Flash had one hit, two walks, one strikeout behind the plate.
Great.
Pitched a couple innings, one dominant inning, one less dominant inning, gave up no hits, however, and didn't kill anybody,
which was
the important thing.
How are the kids now that he is playing? How are the other kids and the other teams? Comparable?
No.
Okay.
I mean, they're good. Your team, his team is better
than the other teams is what I'm asking.
No. So in this case, the two teams were roughly equivalent, I would say. Mm-hmm. Either team could have won both games, or either team could have lost both games. Nobody throws with the velocity Flash throws with. Some control issues, but that's okay. I didn't want to talk about that, though. What I wanted to talk about was I went to see this amazing movie that we're going to talk about later. And during the trailers,
I saw a trailer. That was the highlight of the movie experience.
Red band trailer for a movie that is, I believe, going to be for us as a group, our Citizen Kane. And I had never heard of this before. It is called Good Boys. And it is essentially Superbad for fifth graders.
Yes, so except for the language is as bad as Superbad.
Why don't we play a short clip here?
Okay.
So people can hear some of the introductory dialogue. There's a very funny intro from Seth Rogen to the trailer. Let's listen to that right now.
Hey, kids. As you know, I am one of the producers on your movie, Good Boys. And unfortunately, I'm here with bad news. You guys cannot watch the trailer for your own movie.
What? Are you
kidding?
Are you kidding?
It's just too messed up for kids your age. There's drugs, there's violence, there's swearing. And although we've decided it's okay for you to do these things in the movie, you can't watch yourselves do them in the trailer.
That's fucked up.
Oh, it is fucked up.
Yeah.
You can say that, but you can't watch yourself say that. That's fucked up. Welcome to Hollywood.
See? That's funny. People like that.
The whole thing looks unspeakable. I couldn't stop laughing. And I don't know why. I don't know what it is about this, but I just felt like actually it was a movie about the three of us if we had gone to public school together.
The three of us.
I went to public school.
Would we be friends? That's what I want to know if we were together. I don't know.
Yeah, probably.
I'm friends
with
them.
We're big losers.
As you know, I'm friends with everybody.
Yeah.
This is. Be my friend, please.
You would have been the kid in the trailer who is already ingratiated with the in group. And you're like, can I bring my weirdo friends?
Oh, I'd be that guy. Yeah, and like,
over. Yeah. And that's me and JBL. You very excitedly sent us this trailer last night.
It looks amazing.
And
does it not hit all of your pressure centers?
I was watching Puppet Master: The Littlest Reich at the time, so I put that on pause.
I'm sorry.
It's a movie about watching this and not Vic. It's a movie about Nazi puppets. That go on a murderous rampage. Vic would love it.
Oh.
Vic would love it.
That sounds like Vic's Citizen Kane.
Oh, my gosh. No comment.
So what is happening? I paused the Nazi puppet movie to watch this trailer, and I have to say I don't know what I was expecting, because it's a Red Band trailer. I was expecting, like, lots of nudity, I guess, because the description is boys send a drone over to spy on teenage girls. And I'm like, okay, it's kind of weird to do a Revenge of the Nerds style plot in 2019,
that
but
was
I guess
a great
you can get away with it.
That was a great scene.
But then
Revenge
it's just
the
then it's just like the kids are cursing a lot. I mean,
that's what I
thought. It just looks like Superbad with kids that are younger. And my fear is that it is basically going to be like, look at the kids curse. That's funny, right? It's funny when children curse.
You're not going to believe.
All, it's hysterically funny when children curse.
Okay. You're not going to believe this, but
I'm sorry.
Is it as funny as when the Nazi puppets kill Jewish lesbians? Oh, I don't know. Gosh. I don't know about that.
Did it not do anything for you, Vin?
No, I kind of felt. I believe it or not, I felt the way Sonny did about young kids cursing. You know,
it's kids cursing.
But the other stuff looked funny. There was the action looks funny. The story looks funny. The interesting thing about Molly, the joke about that looks like it's great. But I could do less with the profanity for coming out of kid. I guess I'm getting old. But
what
like,
is happening
here? I don't know.
I don't understand.
Of all people,
you,
I know.
Mr. Lowbrow, man
I know.
Of the people,
I know.
Humor,
I know.
Mr.
I know.
Green,
it's too young
for life.
It's too yes, but it's like
are like no,
like,
I don't.
But they're like 10-year-olds.
Where's the sophisticated humor? I would like to see some intricate words.
No, but
play.
10 or 11. I mean, I could.
Whit Stillman
that.
Actually
see
did a polish on this script. That's why
I can see the ploy, though. I can see the ploy of the draw is young kids cursing. But I hope there's more to it, and we're obviously going to see it. So
I am mapping out future shows, and we've got Shazam coming up soon. We have got. The Hollywood.
Oh, the big one after.
Big,
oh, wait. I'm,
once in
I'm
a
not
long,
here.
Long time in yeah. Hollywood. Mm-hmm. The ninth Quentin Tarantino movie.
Yes.
We've got mm-hmm. Good Boys. Mm-hmm. I'm actually now kind of excited for mm-hmm. spring, summer
what about
movies.
What about Avengers Endgame?
Yeah, that looks great, too. Who's going to live? Who's going to die?
Who's going to live? I was as I was writing my Shazam review, which...
And our second Captain Marvel show.
Yes. Well, so we have...
The celebratory, she has crossed $1 billion show.
We'll get there. Hold on. We'll get there. Sonny.
As I was writing my review of Shazam, I realized that we are like 4 weeks out from the last superhero origin story film. And then there's Shazam, which is a superhero origin story film. And then next week is Hellboy, which, I hate to break it to everyone, is another superhero origin story movie.
How is it an origin?
We're rebooting Hellboy?
Oh, yeah.
With
really?
The same
Neil Marshall is directing David Harbour, I think, the guy from Stranger
yes.
Things.
Yes.
The cop from Stranger Things.
Oh, it's not Ron Perlman.
It's not Ron Perlman. The Guillermo del Toro,
looks
Ron Perlman.
Like
wait, Ron Perlman is gone?
Gone. Yeah, this is... We can,
oh, because he looked just like Ron Perlman in the trailer.
Because
yeah,
he's wearing a bunch
so.
Of prosthetics. I mean, he's made to okay. look like a big
but Hellboy
blocky cartoon.
But Hellboy looks like Ron Perlman.
Right. Not Ron Perlman looks like Hellboy, right. But Hellboy looks like Ron Perlman. Right. Okay.
So I feel like the kid who grabbed the monkey paw and was like, I want superhero movies. And it's just like,
happened.
And it's like the, or maybe the Simpsons where Homer goes to hell and he just shoves the donuts in his mouth. Till he's like on the verge of exploding. That's what I feel like when it comes to the superhero movies. I'm like getting getting a little bit burnt out.
But you're going to get some strong female leads.
Ugh.
I have a question for you, Sonny.
Yeah.
Are you just so excited about your alma mater, UVA, going to the Final Four
yeah,
and winning the whole thing?
1 year after
I think it's
the
good.
First number
so
one seed ever to lose,
I have
right,
a,
Victorino?
I, so this
thank
is,
you for reminding us. It was not Georgetown. It was UVA.
This is
That's
this,
a record holder.
This is an interesting question, right? Because,
yes, Sonny.
Well, first off, I don't really... I'm excited in the kind of platonic, like, this is a thing that is good sort of sense. I'm not excited because I haven't watched a single minute of UVA games this year, with two exceptions. Both of the Duke games. So I watched the first Duke game, which we lost, mm-hmm. and I accidentally watched the second Duke game because it was on in a restaurant when I was there, and it was just like it was on like 7 TVs, so I watched most of it, and we lost that game too. So I made a conscious choice after that not to watch any more UVA basketball games, which I actually like. I prefer college basketball to college football. But the I decided not to watch any more, despite the fact that UVA was very good this year, because I'm a curse. I'm a jinx.
Yeah, you can't watch.
So I can't watch anymore. So I'm excited in, again, the kind of platonic, this is a good thing that mm-hmm. has happened to UVA, and I'm very happy for all of us mm-hmm. Alums of that fantastic school that for once we're in the headlines for reasons other than like gang rapes or whatever. Fake gang rapes,
fake
for
you,
the record.
Thank you.
But so here's the interesting question, though. let's say UVA wins it all. Let's say they win the national title.
First, that would be a first, right?
So, which does that
I don't think so. Didn't they win one with Ralph Sampson?
They went to the Final Four twice with Ralph Sampson, but they
did not win.
They did not win either time. I don't think they made the championship game either time with Ralph Sampson. So the question here is, does it make up, does winning, would winning the national championship, winning the tourney, make up for being the first team ever to be bounced out by first number one seed ever to be bounced out by a 16 seed? And my argument is no, because in 5 years, no one's going to remember UVA won the national title this year. No one will care.
I cannot.
No one will remember.
It's absolutely true. I cannot remember from year to year.
Yeah.
Who the winners? I can't.
I couldn't tell you who won last year. Mm-hmm. I got no idea.
Except for 1984.
So
I disagree entirely.
Okay.
Because if they win this year, because it is back to back with that upset, then the two become inextricably linked in the hists of the mists of memory for forever.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, this becomes part of the story of that defeat. If they were to win 2 years from now, different cast of characters, then no, then yes, you would be correct. But because we're going to follow on the first round loss followed by the championship victory,
you think they'll become inseparable.
Inseparable.
It's an interesting theory, but I still think that the Trivial Pursuit question is which
only one.
School who is the which is the only school that has lost as a number one seed to a 16 seed in the NCAA tournament.
It's just there were some close calls with Georgetown, including with the old man in Princeton,
Pete Carrill, Princeton,
and that game. I can't remember who was on that. The old man's team at the time. It wasn't
Alonzo Mourning.
Yeah, right. So
Dikembe Mutombo. Yeah. I mean, that was a loaded. It was loaded. Team.
There was like three or four NBA starters on that team.
So. Question.
Yes. Yeah.
I remember when the Université of Maryland won their national championship now 15 years, 20 years ago.
Is that Gary Williams?
Gary Williams year.
Yes.
And there was a burning of cars and mattresses and tires throughout
intersections.
The College Park. Maryland area. At Mr. Jefferson's University, how do you believe they would celebrate a national championship?
Interesting question. As somebody who attended a fair number of college basketball games, I would say that we're chiller than that, I think. That being said, UVA has never really won a serious national title before, so I don't know.
They've won a lacrosse national title.
Well, they've won a lot of, and they've won some
and
baseball,
soccer, and national
soccer,
title, some baseball national,
probably
world,
some women's
world
sports.
Series.
I don't know.
Lady sports. Do they have lady sports at Mr. Jefferson's University? Second years to play in the lady sports?
Did you guys fill out your ladies tourney brackets this year?
You once, JVL, helped a
Jackie Goldberg.
Yes. Okay. One namer. Fill out a ladies' bracket. And all you did was pick the higher seeds in each one.
Just chalk.
And then?
Yeah. She was in a very woke pool. This is now 20 years ago.
Oh,
a woke pool where in order to enter the tournament, the actual tournament, you had to fill out two, a men's bracket and a women's bracket. And your final score was calculated on a combination of the two. And she was like, I don't know how to do this. And I said, listen, let me explain this to you. There's only two good teams in women's college basketball. This is at the time.
Diana Taurasi.
Connecticut and Tennessee. You just pick the higher seed every way, all the way to chalk, and then you put Tennessee and Connecticut in the final, and you flip a coin and pick one of the two of them. And she had almost a perfect women's bracket. It was, she came within five games of doing it.
I remember. That's true. I mean, it really was.
I believe
she
won
well.
Her whole tournament based on the strength of her women's bracket.
This is the worst performance in a bracket in my 21, 22 years of
that's
doing
saying
brackets.
Something.
It's saying something.
That's great.
I've never done this.
So it's a special bracket. You will remember this.
I'll remember. I don't know.
What did you do
and
wrong?
It was, I don't
and
know.
If you win the tournament next year, if you win the bracket next year, it'll be combined in your memory.
What did you do wrong?
My final, I picked some great upsets, by the way. I had Liberty. And that was a great upset. But the points, as you know, these are great personal wins when you could pick the 5-12 or 4-13 upsets, but in the long run, the points are meaningless. It's only the big games that count. So my final four was Duke, Florida State, Tennessee, and UNC. And I think that was totally possible.
Came awfully close.
Yeah, no,
you?
I mean, yeah.
All four of those teams were in the Elite Eight.
No,
were they
instead
not?
It's Tech. A listener friend, Steve Hagedorn, also said he's from Dallas and said, go with Tech. I got the text after tip-off. So that didn't help me. Auburn, UVA, and then they went to Michigan State. And I went back and forth with Michigan State and Duke. So that was a struggle. And Michigan State, you know, all with Tom Izzo, always.
Duke does play the right way, though.
They do. The fundamentals. Fundamentals.
You know, I would like to say something on air right now. Just a little long-distance dedication to my boy Ryan Kinney, who I'm not going to explain why, but who has robbed me of the ability to hate Duke and Coach K for the rest of my life.
Personal anecdotes.
Thanks, Ryan.
Personal anecdotes.
I appreciate it. The only thing I have in
my life
is hate. Mm-hmm. And when somebody takes away my ability to hate someone, it is like driving a tiny grapefruit spoon into my heart. Thanks, Ryan. You're such a great guy, Ryan.
I have you ever won the bracket? Outright, like first place.
Outright won. Yeah, I think like in college, forever ago. I mean, I don't do that anymore. I haven't done a bracket in like 9 years.
I remember because we used to do it together. We used to organize it together.
It was the Mattis Last Invitational.
That's right. And remember when we used to plot our picks?
We would go to the Burger King.
Yes.
On K Street.
What is now Fuel Pizza.
Fuel Pizza. When we would sit there with the Washington Post special NCAA tourney.
With Kornheiser and, of course, Feinstein.
Question. Did you have to give the paper to the homeless people who were sleeping next to you on the bench at the Burger King on K Street?
There were always homeless people upstairs. They were in the upstairs unit.
You stayed downstairs.
It kind of got in the way of the smell of the Whopper, but that's okay. Unlike any other.
The bum urine?
So long.
stale stench.
That Burger King still used the microphone system for
orders.
They
call it out. They got to call
where
it out.
Where the people at the registers had a little microphone.
They called it back?
That they would call back.
Oh, that's amazing.
They didn't even have, like, you know, the little screen.
No, they didn't do that. And then
I got a Whopper plain.
Right, no. You had to call up and get it.
Yeah, with large fries.
But the first time I did the pool when I started at the Standard,
you won. Did you?
Second place. I took some, but it was a big pool because it was connected with like Capitol Hill and stuff. I mean, there was a lot of people, and I won second place. And so I took that. This is the year before you came on board, and I went out to lunch with two. I took two other people out to lunch. Polly Koreth,
right?
Who was John Podhoretz's then wonderful executive assistant, and Naomi Rao. Three of us.
District Court.
Yes.
District Court Justice.
And I mean, and it's great to see her because now, look, she's as successful now. It's
as you.
As I am here.
You should ask the clerk for her. Do you need any 45-year-old clerks?
I'm a legal correspondent.
Stop me now if I'm misremembering.
Yes,
but doesn't Naomi Rao herself have a brush with fame from her high school days? Because
I believe she was
the high school tutor of one Christopher Weber.
She knew Chris Weber, I think, at Detroit Country Day.
She tutored him in, like, whatever. Anyway.
Look into that.
I just think that's
a nice story.
I would love him to show up to testify at her confirmation hearing.
Nice story. Do you know where we went to lunch?
Georgetown Seafood.
That's not a bad call. It's not a bad call. You have to go back. It was a Tabard Inn.
Tabard Inn was my second.
I had just discovered. This is before I discovered Morton's or the Palm. And so, Andy Ferguson, when I first came on board, he took me out to lunch and to the Tabard Inn with David Brooks, and that's when I first discovered that world.
It's a real power trio.
It was a power trio. Again,
Ferguson,
and look at
Brooks,
us now.
Mattis.
Look at the three of us now.
Look at you.
You know? And
I'm sorry, is David Brooks the executive editor of a successful national
publication?
I don't think so. No, what he's he's just a writer.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's right.
He's just a writer.
Are you still
this conversation has to be fascinating for like
I know a lot of people for 17 people who love the inside. Are you a fan of the Tabard? Do you like the Tabard still?
Well, I mean, they don't put your picture on the wall if you
go
there.
No, they don't. They don't.
You know, they don't give you private wine lockers if you're a high roller, do they?
They don't. And I mean, they were nice, but I liked the food, except for it was crowded. Always, it was very noisy. Everyone's crammed in. It was, you know, like a circus. Speaking of circuses, over the weekend,
that's really great. Ooh,
man, that was a hard one.
You really powered through. You really powered through. You were like,
the whole point of even talking about the brackets was to get to Dumbo.
That was a seven-minute transition.
7 minute time it. You're wondering, really, like, where am I going with this? Okay, over the weekend.
You know what that is? That's the Neil Peart drum solo of transitions.
Right, oh, it's coming on. Right, right. 5 minutes, fast forward, still going. I'm still going. Okay. Over the weekend, Dumbo flew to the top spot at the box office with $45 million, followed by Us with $33 million, and in third place, Captain Marvel with $20.5 million, and it has now broken the billion-dollar mark.
Captain Marvel has grossed over $1 billion, as I predicted it would.
Box office thoughts, guys.
I'm a genius.
I have a question, yeah. Sonny. At what point do these live-action Disney reboots become unprofitable? Are we close to it?
Dumbo's going to lose money. But I think it's safe.
It's not the first one, is it? I mean, haven't a bunch of these done kind of poorly?
No.
I mean, Maleficent did great, but didn't the Jungle Book one?
Maleficent did fine. Jungle Book did $1 billion.
Oh, it did? Okay.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it did.
I remember when we reviewed that, because we do a lot of reviews of very popular billion-dollar movies.
Hold on. Let me just pull it up. I'm pretty sure... It grossed $966 million, so close to a billion. Maleficent did okay. Maleficent did fine, but that's not really a reboot. That's more of a reimagining, I feel like. It's taking the...
Did the Cinderella reimagining
Cinderella
okay?
did well. Beauty and the Beast was an enormous hit. So I think Dumbo is going to be the first one that loses money.
Can I tell you why?
Sure,
because
it's bad.
Eva Green does not take her top off.
True
movies
fact.
Where Eva Green takes her shirt off are every single one of them... over $800 million in worldwide grosses.
Oh, this is... I'd have to check the numbers on that.
What was that movie, the weird French movie that she was
in? The Daydreamers?
In? Yeah.
Maybe.
Dreamers. The Dreamers.
Whatever.
Well, if you search that...
Well, it was an art film. Bertolucci. It was Bertolucci.
It was Bertolucci. And you can actually watch that. I watched that movie on Daily Motion.
You watched the whole movie on Daily Motion?
Yeah, I didn't know the movie was only 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But apparently, that's the movie. Okay.
So Dumbo's a disaster. It cost it had a production budget of $170 million. I assume they spent at least $100 million.
Who could have guessed that stupid effing movie would turn out to be a bad effing movie?
Yeah.
Dumbo's one of the worst of the Disney animated movies. Right?
Nobody denied Pinocchio, this. You know? I mean, I didn't... In terms of a story,
I have no strong feelings on Dumbo, the original. But the remake, or this live-action one, is horrendously boring.
Oh.
Just boring. Just dull and uninteresting.
Did you like... I mean, because here's Colin Farrell again, right? And he sort of has this new role. Did you like him in Saving Mr. Banks? Did you see him saving Mr. Banks?
You know, I didn't actually see Saving Mr. Banks.
It's on Netflix.
I didn't see Saving Mr. Banks.
You should see it. I liked it, surprisingly.
I like Colin Farrell a lot, but I don't like him in this sort of movie where he plays the straight man dad figure. I like him.
Yeah, he's
when
a
he's,
dad in Mr. Banks too.
I like him when he's fiending for mojitos in Miami Vice or Hitman in Bruges. I like him when he's a little bit weird. I prefer him in Daredevil. Remember when he was in Daredevil and he played Bullseye? He's fantastic.
That's a terrible movie.
Terrible movie, but he's very good.
Every minute he's on screen is great. Yeah. What was his big breakout?
Minority Report.
Yes.
Well, that's right. It was
because he was the cop who was chasing
Whitwer.
Fantastic.
Whitwer was his name.
I guess.
Okay, all the way down in 10th place. I forgot to mention this in the box office lineup. All the way down in 10th place was The Beach Bum, starring Matthew McConaughey.
How did it get that high?
$1.8 million. So that's not a great opening weekend for that. But for some reason...
$1,600 a screen. That's a ton of money.
For some reason, we're talking about this movie as well as the Motley Crue biopic, Dirt. Well, this is the Men Behaving Badly episode.
I figured... I pitched this as a show because I couldn't in good conscience subject you to Dumbo.
I'd take Dumbo.
Oh.
Yeah, knowing what we know now, Sonny, I think I might just check out Dumbo. Do you want to just talk about The Beach Bum first and we can get to Dirt later?
People need a big boy review of Beach Bum because
really?
Nobody is going to see this movie.
That's right.
The Beach Bum stars Matthew McConaughey at his most Matthew McConaughey as kind of a... as a literal beach bum. He's a poet and a writer who is living in the Keys of Florida. We're kind of going back and forth between Miami and the Keys. And he just lives his life, man. He's just living his life one day at a time. He's getting drunk, doing some poetry. He's living with his wealthy wife, hanging out with Snoop Dogg, who's not really Snoop Dogg in this movie, but basically a Snoop Dogg. It's basically what you would imagine Matthew McConaughey and Snoop Dogg and Isla Fisher... like in real life, if they all lived together and they had $1 billion and could just do whatever they want. The plot of this movie strikes me as vaguely unimportant.
Also non-existent.
Not quite non-existent. The plot of the movie would be the following. Matthew McConaughey is a burnt-out writer who, after his incredibly wealthy wife dies, is forced to finish his brilliant novel in order to inherit her money. And so that would be the bare bones plot of the film, right? That's what happens in it. But none of this really matters. What it is a similar Harmony Korine movie. Harmony Korine made Spring Breakers, which I like a lot. I don't know if you guys have seen. I think Vic would like it a lot.
I saw it on Daily Motion. That's amazing. Go ahead.
And Trash Humpers and some other movies. But like it is very much a movie about kind of putting you in a milieu and in a place and just letting the things happen. I don't think it's very good. I don't think it works. I don't think this works. Spring Breakers I liked a lot. This I don't think works. But I do find some of the reactions to it pretty interesting. That being said, I liked the look of the film. I liked the kind of Florida sunsets and sunrises and, you know, laid back trash people doing their trash people things. I don't know.
My mother.
Two stars. Two out of four.
My mother-in-law has never been a fan of Florida, and this movie would really just sum it up for her about why she would not like Florida. But I'm open. I like this idea, and I wanted to like this movie before knowing really what it was about, and then I was just so let down by a lot of things about this movie. But what I wanted to like about this movie is the idea of having, you know, this more zen, mellow character, Moondog, and that nothing gets to him, you know, and that he...
Moondog is the Matthew McConaughey.
Matthew McConaughey's character.
I just call him Matthew McConaughey. He's
Hunter S. Thompson-ish in a way.
And, no.
Jimmy Buffett-ish.
He is.
He is. Exactly. You made me wonder how much of it is, you know, him or what, but anyway. But I was very disappointed, and I did want to like it because I understand the message, which is that, you know, the life we lead is way too stressful, and we go to work and we do all these things, and what we need more in life is more mellowness, calm, and meditation. JVL.
That's a nice transition. Hey, it's sponsor time for our favorite sponsor, Calm.com. So Calm.com, C-A-L-M.com, is an app for your phone. They have meditations on it and breathing exercises. And what we use them for in my house, sleep stories. Allow me to tell you all a true story, which happened exactly 6 hours ago when Favorite came in and tapped me on the shoulder at 0400 hours and said, "Hi, Daddy, I'm really hungry and I've been lying in bed for an hour and I can't get to sleep." And so I said, "Oh, okay, well, let's go downstairs and have a bowl of Cheerios." And so we went downstairs. I made myself an espresso. I gave her a bowl of Cheerios. I said, "Now come on back upstairs." I pulled her into bed with me, and I put on Calm.com, as I always do, with my special friend Tamara Levitt. And we put on Luna's Lullaby. So this is Luna's Lullaby and the lovely voice of Tamara.
"Hi, my name's Tamara, and tonight I'll be reading a story called Luna's Lullaby."
90 seconds later, Favorite was asleep. Stone cold dead asleep. It's like I had given her knockout gas or something. It's amazing. So this is, Calm.com has many uses. Parents can use it to meditate, to give themselves a little more peace of mind when they think about how lovely their children are and how rich they've made their lives. But what we use it for is that it puts our kids to sleep. It's amazing. So right now you can get 25% off of a Calm premium subscription. Just go to calm.com/WFB. That's calm.com/WFB. It gets you unlimited access to all of their content, all the sleep stories. They're constantly putting out new sleep stories with new readers. It's so great. I really cannot emphasize this enough to anybody who has kids. You should go and get Calm today.
Thank you, JVL. Now, you saw The Beach Bum last night or the other night?
Yesterday.
Okay. Tell us your thoughts.
So this movie is not for me.
Mm-hmm.
this movie was not meant for people like me. I am probably the last person in all of America who has never touched a drug, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. period, the end. Mm-hmm. I don't drink very often. Even back when I was a kid, I drank very little. It just does not have a lot of appeal to me. I am much more of a control freak. I do not like not being in total control of everything in my life at all times. Throughout this entire movie, I had one overriding impulse. And I think I texted this to you guys.
Yes.
I walked out.
Yes.
I wanted to take the entire state of Florida and every man, woman, and child in it and fire them into the sun because I hate all of them. I hate them so much, I can't even tell you. I just, the idea that there is a whole part of America which is allowed to vote, where people don't do anything. They just are like, hey, it's Jimmy Buffett. Let's have a stoner comedy. Where do these people, who pays these people's mortgages? Who pays for their drinks? Where do they sleep? What are their 401ks like? Who's going to take care of them when they're 70? All of this is made possible by the largesse of the welfare state, and that this is decadence. This is what decadence and late-stage capitalism looks
right.
like.
Wow. If this movie came out during the Cold War, the Soviets would have said, we want a copy of The Beach Bum, and we're going to show it to everybody in the Soviet Union, and you want that? This is what's out there.
It drove me insane. I hated every single character. I hated his daughter, who was like the moral center of the. I hated everybody. And there's no plot. And I hate it as a movie, mm-hmm. too. I would say it isn't just the repugnance and the moral repulsion I feel. I hate it as a qua movie.
Yeah.
There's no plot. The characters are not interesting. This whole thing has no reason to exist. It's not a stoner comedy. It's not a story. It's not a tableau. Everything about it is flabby and stupid.
To that point, I was looking for a turning point. Where is the turning point? Oh, this is the part where, wow, he's going to have to sober up and clean up his act for one thing or another. Oh, the daughter's wedding. This is a moment for him and he's going to change. Oh, you know, a terrible car accident. Spoiler alert for the one person who might see this movie.
My theater was totally empty. What was your guys like?
There were two other people in my theater.
There was like maybe five or six, and this is at Tyson's, and that's that huge theater. And then I thought, okay, now he's going to change his ways, you know. And that was a Sunday. Keep in mind, you'll remember this, Javi. This was the Sunday of the prodigal son sermon. And so I thought, this guy is the prodigal son. Is he going to return? No, he just the prodigal son who never came home. And he has. You're right. He has no qualms sleeping under a bridge or in a multimillion-dollar mansion because for him, like, homelessness is a choice. But
he's
just
living his life, man.
I like the idea that, you know what, nothing sets him, you know, that's okay. Nothing gets him down except for all of the setbacks of his life largely are of his own doing, you know?
But it's also wildly improbable. So he, every once in a while, the movie sort of does this, it jabs you in the ribs to remind you, hey, this guy really is a genius, because they haven't, quote, Baudelaire or D.H. Lawrence. Mm-hmm. And the idea that some stoned-out, drunk, addict, junkie would actually remember D.H. Lawrence or Baudelaire, I would say, is exactly zero. There is no world in which this happens.
The people
who live like that are just bums and junkies.
Yeah, yeah.
The bums lost, Mr. Lebowski.
you're very Big Lebowski right now.
Oh my God. Because the movie actually reminds me quite a lot of the Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
If the dude was a more boring and uninteresting character, mm-hmm. was more dissolute, had fewer motivations, and then was posited as the actual hero of the event, because it's not a story. There's no story. So everything about it is just terrible.
Part of me wonders if we are supposed to take this on it, take Moondog on his face as the hero of the film. I'm not 100% sure that he is supposed to be actually. I don't know that we are supposed to regard him as a genius. I mean, the joke, like the big joke of the film in my mind is the poem that he wins his big award for, which is about his penis and being inside. And it's so bad. It's so obviously bad that I can't believe we're meant to take this man seriously.
Oh, you mean like the joke's on us?
Right, right. Well, no, not the joke's on us. Just that we're like. I just don't think that we are supposed to believe everyone when they say he's a genius. I don't know. Maybe I'm giving Corinne too much credit here. So here I have a question for you guys about criticism theory, Okay. So let's posit that.
Could you find that for Vic? He looks very confused. Yeah.
So let's posit that this person like is deeply unappealing and like an awful person and like a bad role model and all that stuff. And let's also posit that the movie is not very good, right? Just as a piece of storytelling. You know, you can make a case for it on the merits of the filmmaking, you know, the shot selections and the lighting and the mood that it creates. I think it does what it sets out to do successfully. It's just what it wants to do is stupid. How are critics supposed to balance these things? Because I bring this up because there was a review of the film that like drove me a little bit crazy. I sent it to you guys.
Yes, the Chicago Reader.
The Chicago Reader review. The subheadline of which is if you're a white rich male you can get away with anything, and the review kind of goes on from there. You know, it's just another story about a brilliant white guy that we're supposed to admire both for their brilliance and for their it's impossible to watch the flagrantly repulsive Moondog grope everything within reach without thinking about hashtag Me Too and the forgive them because they make brilliant art attitude which made Harvey Weinstein and R. Kelly possible. Then there's Moondog's wife, Minnie, played with bubbly carnality by Isla Fisher, who steals every scene she's in. She could easily have been taken the whole movie from McConaughey if Corinne had let her, which he adamantly does not. Minnie is very rich, enjoys getting high and having sex as much as Moondog, and so she has to be punished. So, there's a critique of this film that is based essentially on morals and politics and ideology, and there's a critique of the film that is based on the filmmaking itself. And which of these do you think matters more, or should critics care about more?
JVL, please.
So I read that essay in the Chicago Reader, and it's insanely stupid. And I read it actually before I went to the movie, which, if anything, predisposed me to like the Beach Bum just out of spite.
Yes.
And I couldn't do
same.
It.
Same. So. Absolutely same.
I would say this. In a way, though, I don't blame the Chicago Reader for that, because what else is there to critique?
Mm-hmm.
So when I said, why does this movie exist? I meant this quite sincerely. Why does this movie exist? Yeah. I understand independent cinema. I understand experimental cinema. This sort of fails along all of those vectors. It has no idea behind it. It has no story behind it. The setting and scene, even the, like, you know, just the idea of like plopping in and inhabiting a world is uninteresting. Nothing about it says like, hey, I have a reason for being. And so in absence of that, if you're a critic who like wants to write about it, what else do you have to do mm-hmm. except like bring your own more? I mean, you got to like you literally have to come up with something to say about it.
This is very much an instance where a reviewer is filling the movie with his own ideological hangups.
Movie doesn't have anything else to talk about.
Yeah. I mean
that's I don't blame the reviewer.
Yeah.
It's insipid. I don't like it.
Yeah.
And I think he's wrong. But on the other hand, like, what else are you supposed to talk about with a stupid movie like this that has nothing in it? It's just hollow.
Yeah.
Okay. No? Do you disagree?
No, I do kind of. I think that this is what a bad reviewer does. I would say that a bad reviewer takes the thing that confounds him and is perhaps intentionally confounding and fills it with his own persnickety hangups. I think that's not what a critic should be doing. That being said, I understand the impulse, and I frankly would probably wind up doing something similar if I decided to write about this, because I wouldn't know how to verbalize or, you know, vocalize or write down, you know, the things that are bad about the film. Mm-hmm. Or the things that work about the film, because I do think parts of it work. Again, just as a,
there's only one part of this whole movie that works.
Yeah, which one?
Martin Lawrence.
Martin Lawrence. I literally did laugh out loud when the shark came out of the water in my empty theater.
But everything,
I guffawed.
Everything about Martin Lawrence. So Martin Lawrence's character is introduced as the dude comes onto a pier to go fishing, and Martin Lawrence's character is sitting there, and the very first information you get about him is, he says, you know, how's your business? And Martin Lawrence says, it's so good, I actually just bought a second boat. And so you are primed to think, okay, so this guy is like a respectable person that the dude knows. That's not the character. A Moondog.
Moondog.
A Moondog knows. And as you start looking, like Martin Lawrence, he's wearing a captain's outfit, but then you sort of look closely and it's worn shabby.
Yeah.
And then he starts talking about the things he does on his boat and he gives dolphin tours. You're like, okay, this makes sense. And then he starts talking about, you know, we've only had 4 fatalities in the last 4
right.
years.
I've only been suspended 5 times. Yeah. I've only had my license.
Suspended 5 times. And then.
Which he says is very low in the business of dolphin watching.
We start swerving even more, where it turns out that he has a deep, deep love for dolphins that is almost Troy McClure-like.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so clearly he has a sexual affinity for dolphins. Something. And as all of this is happening, you then get a family who comes to his ratty boat to go see the dolphins. He drives them out. He says, there they are. And you see him, he's putting on a wetsuit, he's going to go swimming with the dolphins, and then they show you what are clearly shark fins.
Right, you look at it, you already know. The first time I saw him, that's not a dolphin.
Now, this is only like 7 minutes of the movie.
It's definitely the best part of it.
This 7 minutes is an absurdist sort of triumph, I think, in its own way. This could have, you should never like criticize a movie for not being what you wanted it to be, but you could have seen this as being a stoner version of The Odyssey.
Yeah.
Right, where he is Odysseus making his way through a series of trials and in meeting interesting people.
Good and bad, too.
Good, right. And if this movie had been that, then the Martin Lawrence vignette fits within that structure.
How do you feel the Martin Lawrence vignette compares to the Zac Efron vignette? Zac Efron plays a Christian rock addled pastor's kid who's in rehab with Moondog.
Prayer warrior.
And breaks out.
thinks he's a tiger. Yeah. Thinks it is okay to mug old people because Jesus has already forgiven you and died on the cross.
Jesus died on the cross.
That's a very distinct view.
That's a very distinct view,
and
by the way.
I have to say, so in that vignette, Zac Efron is fantastic. But the vignette itself doesn't really go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is, again, so you're introduced to this really interesting character and you're sort of interested to spend a little bit of time with him, but then it just kind of doesn't move anywhere.
It starts at him being an absurd caricature of a evangelical type and, like, never really goes anywhere from there. It just, like, it starts at 11. Whereas the Martin Lawrence starts at about 5.
And then ratchets
up to 3.
Yeah, and then goes to 15.
No, absolutely.
No, I agree with this. There are like little bits in the movie that I like. I don't understand, for instance, what exactly Snoop Dogg is in this
lingerie
movie. Is he a
rapper?
A rapper.
Yeah.
Why do all of his minions have submachine guns?
Well, that's security.
No. So what has happened is he is a guy who got rich with a couple hit records. And no longer makes records and now just does weed.
Yeah.
And I think the guys are there to basically secure his stash because he has got
so much weed.
And he's got this giant, 400-foot luxury yacht. Yeah. And,
Is it Isla Fisher?
I think it's Isla.
But she does not steal every scene in this movie. I like her a ton.
I did feel like that was basically her as herself. But, Is she
a stoner too?
My understanding is that she is a wild spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. A free spirit.
She's a free spirit. Yeah.
But the idea that, because they have this luxury that they don't really think about, but they have, which is 100. Somebody worked. Like, she doesn't work, and Moondog doesn't work. Mm-hmm. But somebody had to work in her family, a grandfather or somebody who didn't spend their time just wandering around Key West, stoned. I just found nothing redeeming.
All of these people.
I like the idea of being mellow. I plan on being mellow in a couple weeks when I'm away, as you know.
The deep reading of this film is that Matthew McConaughey actually dies in that car wreck, and the rest of the film is his trials through hell, which end up with him almost burning himself to death in that boat.
This is a hot take here on the spot.
The boat is Charon crossing the lake.
Yeah,
and fire.
Fire. Yeah, that is. Yeah. I guess, sure. Why not?
The whole time,
I would say at multiple points in the moment, in the back of my head, I heard a voice saying, "Got to get that fish."
This feels like a bookend to Serenity.
Totally.
How bad is it that I like that movie more than this movie?
Serenity is much better.
We
all liked it.
We all liked Serenity. Mm-hmm. Didn't you like Serenity?
It's weird. Anyway, but it is
man of the people over here.
It is
C.
It is C plus. No. The beach bump.
The beach bump.
I was originally going to give it an F, and then I let it sink in a little bit. I like the music. I like Snoop Dogg. I ended up with a C-.
C-.
But you look know what? Yeah, worse than Widows. I thought it was worse than Widows.
Worse than Widows. You dick.
What was there enough? Did enough people see it to give a statistically significant
score?
Cinema score.
I don't think it got a cinema score. Cinema. No, you only get a cinema score if you're in more than 2,000 screens, I think.
Okay.
And it was only on 1,100.
No, I mean, there was potential. You could have done something if you had more of an arc, more of a plot, something that happens. Maybe, you know, something happens with Moondog that he's aiming towards something, you know? But instead, I mean, because, I mean, there's a cast there, and it's quite a motley crew. Speaking of which.
Hey!
Moving on to the next subject.
1,500 screens, by the way.
Okay.
And it only opened in 1,100. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay, so with the time that we have
the
left,
The Dirt.
Okay. The Dirt is not in theaters. It's on Netflix, and it is a biopic. So, you know, you have Bohemian Rhapsody, right? And
Rocket Man.
Rocket Man is
coming
up. Oh,
that's the other one we're going to do that I can't wait
for.
That.
Oh, I'm going to see that one.
Are you actually excited for that?
I think it looks kind of interesting.
Yes, I like Elton John.
You just want to see Chav King Arthur do Elton John?
He's not Chav King?
Oh, no, that's right. No, Chav Robin Hood. He's Chav Robin Hood.
And so on piggybacking on that is Motley Crue biopic The Dirt. And a lot of people angry about this movie because of its glorification of men behaving badly. But this was the 80s. And you can't say, oh, this didn't happen. You can't change. You're not going to do Caligula and say, oh, he wasn't like that. You know, there's going to be a horse. There's going to be a horse involved. And in the dirt, somebody's going to be licking urine. Okay. Sonny, what did you think? We watched The Dirt here?
We did watch The Dirt here. The Dirt is the perfect sort of movie to watch.
Can you do a review?
What's the point of doing a review? It's the story of Motley Crue. And I, like,
there are no angels.
It's about them having sex and doing drugs. And there's a car accident in this movie, too, that sets someone down a different path, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I don't care. Here's what I'll say. It's better than Bohemian Rhapsody.
You know, it's funny. I felt the exact same way. It's not just a little bit better than Bohemian Rhapsody. It's a lot better than Bohemian Rhapsody.
It's just more honest with what the subject matter is.
Yes.
It's
more so interestingly shot.
Yeah, and it's better edited.
The multiple narrators. Yeah. I like the idea of each band member telling a side of the story, and I thought they all had interesting takes.
So I would say that The Dirt is the perfect sort of movie to watch at 2 p.m. on a Friday afternoon with Vic Madison, Aaron Harrison, where you're
at your office.
Where you're in the office when you're passing a bottle of Wild Turkey 101 back and forth. Between each other. It's that sort of movie.
Don't forget all the lines we did. We did a lot of lines.
A lot of lines.
What did HR think about that? Did you show it on the big screen?
We brought it in here. We brought it in here. We threw it up on this TV.
Great.
It's fine. It's fun. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. It is a celebration of grotesquery. But it is honest in what it is doing.
Just a bunch of fun-loving boys.
And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it quite a bit. I think it really has a true artistry to it, really. I mean, like the scene where, is it Nikki Sixx who decides he wants to give up heroin? Oh. Or no, it's Nikki Sixx who he's like, you know, I found the most beautiful woman in the world, and you think he's in a strip club and there's a nude woman there and she's holding a tray, and you think like, oh, this is the woman, this is the love of his life that he's found. Turns out he's talking about heroin. It's a metaphor.
I was fooled.
Symbolism.
I was fooled.
So the movie itself is ridiculous and absurd and a lot of fun, and who you know, like, it's hard to get as angry as some people really are about this movie because of it.
Are people
so,
really angry about it?
A lot of critics don't. A lot of critics don't like this, and they don't like the Netflix's The Highwaymen. Two celebrations of, you know,
men.
of various ideas of masculinity,
from a different time. Yes,
from a very different time.
So, from two
very different times.
I liked The Dirt. I thought it was interesting. What is Sonny? I mean, JVL.
No surprise there. From the first 30 seconds of this movie, I thought to myself, this is boy, I hope movie. Gene comes in for this
movie. No, he didn't. No. The thing is, again, like I said, this actually happened. But I've always been complaining of the last couple decades that you just don't see gratuitous nudity anymore in movies. And boy, this had it in spades. It was just everywhere.
So did the beach bum, though.
Yeah.
It wasn't good.
No, that wasn't good. That was not good. The scene in the kitchen with the spatula, not good. This was
just
kind
living
of
living his life, man.
It was a real throwback to the 80s in that way, in true spirit. I thought it was great because, you see when they start the rise, Motley Crue's rise, and you see the opening act or they're performing alongside, and you saw some great old names from the past. Number one, Quiet Riot. And number two, later on the marquee, you saw Dokken. I remember Dokken. But at some point in time, as the decline begins, one of the band members walks past the wall, and what do you see? Is a big poster of
Pearl Jam.
Pearl Jam, exactly. Yep. Because for me,
again, artistry. Yes. You see the decline in the background. It's not shoved in your face.
At some point, I just remember in reality in the 90s, where just all of a sudden heavy metal was gone. It's like, what happened to the heavy metal bands? What happened, headbangers? All that stuff, just for me, just seemed to disappear. Grunge had taken over everything, and it was just a different sound. And all these other, bands, it became a struggle. And then, of course, you see that in the movie. So in the movie, there are hardships that they have to get over, and some of them are really heartbreaking, with Vince Neil, for example.
They didn't really dwell on the dead child subplot. That was
they did enough
for
me.
The best.
It was definitely for the best.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's all I needed. I didn't want to see more. That was very hard. And I liked it. So the other thing I thought was great. The casting was good. The girl who plays Heather Locklear was a dead ringer for her. And I got confused watching this because I was like, I always associated Heather Locklear for some reason with the band Bon Jovi, and then I was thinking about Richie Sambora. But wait a minute, so she dated her? Oh, wait a minute, no, she dated both, and she married both, right?
Yeah, right.
Mm. And there you have it.
It was a different time.
That's how she rolled, Heather Locklear. JVL.
First of all, I understand that Rami Malek was helped to his Oscar by everybody from craft services to the best boys and the gaffers, and there may have been a director on set.
That movie was not directed by anyone.
I thought the performances by a bunch of no-name actors I've never seen in this were much more winning.
Yeah, no.
And they are not impersonations. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're just playing. They're actually coming up with characters, mm-hmm, and playing the characters.
The characters.
And the characters they come up with, yeah, are really great. And again, mm-hmm, they do pull, I think, a neat trick. Not a cheap trick.
JVL,
a neat trick of really selling the idea that these are just boys being boys, which is what keeps you from hating them.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think they're rock stars being rock star, then there's no way to not hate them. But the movie is selling you the idea, which again, I'm sure is not true, but as qua movie making, that these are just boys being boys. Nicky is just filling this hole in his heart because of his terrible home life. Vince,
Tommy Lee looks like he came from a very nice family.
Tommy Lee comes from like a totally normal family. He's a lover, not a fighter. He just,
it's guy, except guy, when he's always, it does kind of gloss over the whole beating women thing. And also posit that they kind of have it coming. I would say this movie is far more immoral in certain aspects than The Beach Bum is.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. So you got to read this movie as a movie and not as a biopic, yeah, right? And as a movie, it's telling a much more interesting story,
sure,
and a kind of winning story. The central fact, though, and this is what they do get right, is that the attraction of Motley Crue was the lifestyle, was the act. The music was not the act. The lifestyle was the act. And Vince Neil even sort of says this at one point when he says, this Dr. Feelgood, this whole album has two good songs on it. Everything else is crap. And I'm the one who understands it because I'm the only sober one on stage and I'm trying to sell it every night. And I, mm-hmm, see people's, mm-hmm, reactions to, mm-hmm, it. And what people reacted to was the bad boy behavior. Like that was the act. And they don't try to turn it into something it's not, unlike, say, Bohemian Rhapsody, which tries to turn Queen into, the greatest musical thing since Mozart or something.
Right. I owned Theater of Pain on cassette tape. My father gave it to me. It was like, when I was in eighth grade, he's like, you know, I walked into Camelot Records, you know, in the
Camelot
mall, Ocean County Mall. I walked to Camelot Records, and it was everywhere. So I just figured, hey, what, you know, why did you have it? So I had, and it was good tape. It was good tape. I do have.
You're so old.
I know we are, because, I mean, nobody remembers Theater of Pain. A lot of our listeners are younger, but I do have a list of my top five Motley Crue songs, if you want to. If I can.
Are there five good Motley Crue songs?
Ready? Okay, here we go. Number five, Dr. Feelgood. Number four, Home Sweet Home. Number three, Unskinny Bop. Number two, Every Rose Has Its Thorn. And number one, Pour Some Sugar on Me. Those are great Motley Crue songs. Okay.
The joke here is that those are not all Motley Crue songs,
what?
Right?
What? What are you talking about?
Can I tell you, is there something else? And this is the type of thing that normally I object to in movies, is cameos. Normally, I think the cameos sort of, it's not there for you, or if it's there for you, it's cheap fan service. Here, the David Lee Roth, which is a 45-second bit where I think he says one thing, because he's just sitting stoned on
a
couch.
The mirror smashes on him.
And a mirror smashes. And then Ozzy Osbourne. I think they're great.
No,
because
absolutely.
What they're doing is they're trying to set up a... They're showing you what it was like in the L.A. rock scene in the 80s, which is what this was all about. It was, I mean, the L.A. was a scene.
Was
this is where Guns N' Roses comes from.
Absolutely.
That's where Skid Row, all of these bands
the opening
come out
Whiskey
of Los
a
Angeles.
Go-Go, the whole thing.
And I kind of loved it. As a period piece.
I gave it a B+.
Sonny?
You B+? This is a solid A from you.
Yeah, I was going to say, for you, this is an A+. I can't believe... Why are you?
I don't know. I was just, you know,
grading down.
I'm trying to be tougher. But B+. I liked it. Okay.
I don't know. B is fine. I mean, it's fine. It's entertaining.
I give it a C+.
It's absurd. C+. C+ is a little bit low.
not where I come from.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I think we're all set. I want to move on really quickly to corrections, additions, and shout outs. I want to give a shout out to a friend and listener, Charlie, who is a longtime fan of the show and gave us a board game called Lords of the Waterdeep.
He's pulling it out to show everyone.
The game. Pulling out the board game. Thank you. Take a look at this. It's massive.
This is right up my alley.
Yes. Okay. So Charlie writes us and he says that he's hopeful. He says that your
group, I'm sorry. It's not called Lords of the Waterdeep.
It's Dungeons and Dragons.
It is actually Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, it's Dungeons and Dragons on the bottom there. Okay. So he says, I'm hopeful your group will at least give it a try. It's great for a wide age group. Easy to learn. Has a nice bit of D&D flavoring without actually making you pick up a set of dice.
Wasn't that the whole point?
I'd like the dice. I will keep my fingers crossed that at least one of you finds it worthy, Sonny, and that you were not disappointed it wasn't a bottle of single malt, Sonny.
I've never played any of these games, so I don't...
All right, so here's what happened. Yesterday, I consulted with two experts in the field. Okay.
Look at
I know it's a massive map. It's a massive
but
map.
But it's really nice.
Yeah,
this
it's
is a
very
high
nice.
Game.
It's very it's a thick board map. So I consulted two experts on this kind of thing.
Did you ask Tom?
No, I asked Paul Crookston and Stephen Kutowski. Thank you. Yes, Sonny. And who work at the Free Beacon. One of the things is, I mean, they were intrigued by the game. They looked at it, but they scolded me for assuming that role playing and board game people are the same people. And apparently they're not. So,
but wait, is this not?
This is
not
kind of a
playing?
Hybrid. This is interesting. This is a hybrid. It's more. There's board game elements and there's role playing elements. But I do have to tell you that that Paul and Stephen were offended.
This is the Venn diagram of those two things.
The Venn diagram that JBL
diagram.
The Venn diagram
and role.
It's basically 90% overlap.
This like right.
Let me tell you. I talked to them and the role playing game people. Those are the nerds.
Oh sure.
He says us.
Okay. Well, anyway, thank you very much,
this is
Charlie.
Punching down.
Thank you very much, Charlie. Okay. That's all the time we're giving to this episode. Questions, comments, complaints, compliments. Tweet us at Victorina Mattis at Sunny Bunch. Again, be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or Google Play. Just type in Subbeacon under podcasts. We're there. Leave a review. Tell your friends. Until next time.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-da-ba-da.
So?
Question.
Yes.
I'm surprised you didn't have anything to say about the dark elf on the cover of Lords of the Waterdeep Air.
Oh, she's a... Let me... Oh, yeah. That's great. No, she looks terrific. she looks terrific, and she's holding this wand.
You never told us anything about how your weekend was.
Everything was fine. Everything was fine. It was an uneventful, quiet weekend. I think I can't actually remember what I did. My folks were visiting, so that was nice.
How's your RG?
Good. I'm losing weight, you know, and I'm doing the 16-8 or 17-7 fast. And that's been working out.
How does that work exactly?
You just don't eat for 16 or 17 hours. So my window of eating is between like 12 and 8 or 11 and 7. And then you don't eat again until the following day, until the following lunch. And it sort of resets the metabolism so that your body is only processed. So you, as opposed to my constantly eating throughout the day and night, you stop that. But there are limits. You don't want to overcompensate, and that happens. But I've lost maybe 5 pounds.
This is once more where science pings from. This is like never sleep your baby on the back. Mm-hmm. Always sleep your baby on the back. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if you remember this, but like 10 years ago, the whole idea we ought to be grazing.
Oh yeah, grazing. You know, no, snacking throughout the day.
Like big meals. What you really want to do is just take little hits.
Also pasta.
All
got
day
a carb load. Carb loading.
This is nobody knows anything. Mm-hmm.
But it is working. It is working.
You know,
I will tell you that.
You know,
I do feel better.
You know how you lose weight? You consume fewer calories than you burn.
Mm-mm. That's scientifically
by working out.
That is scientifically
that's literally
not
the only
true
thing that matters. That is, it doesn't matter how you eat that, it or in
that,
which order
is,
or what kind of calories.
That's not
it's
true
just
at all.
Fewer calories come in.
That's not true.
I have a friend of the show who I will not mention by name, but who has been doing real fasting.
Oh, no. The 24-hour one?
I believe
48?
His record is like 16 days.
Oh, no, you can't. And you're living on like
he's a
water
monk.
You're like water,
just
coffee.
Water and some coffee.
And
water and some coffee. And he says tons more energy. He feels great. And that everything is, that is hard. Core. That is biblical fasting.
No, this is it. I mean, look, we're getting to the end of the show right here, and I can barely function. I can't even get out of my chair right now.
I'm sure it's fine.